Day two of Rohatsu Sesshin, celebrating Buddha's awakening. For those who haven't heard, Rohatsu literally means December 8th, which in the Zen tradition is the day that marks Buddha's great enlightenment under the Bodhi tree around 2,500 years ago. And Rohatsu Sesshin is an ancient tradition of celebrating Buddha's awakening by practicing his practice for 7 days leading up to his awakening, and then celebrating it with a ceremony at the end, which we'll do. So, to celebrate Buddha's awakening, we're looking into the story of this awakening in this Mahayana Sutra called the Lalita Vistara Sutra. The extensive play scripture of the Buddha. Related to this word lila, that's like divine play of the universe. Interesting that this is the sutra that basically is just the story of Buddha's life, but it's called the play, the extensive description of the Buddha's play. And that gets brought out a little bit in some of these passages, that what we see is the story of Buddha's life, and that happened like it did, is actually kind of like a play, like a theatrical play, and kind of like play, like a children's play, like the Buddha's life, even some of these extreme practices in which he maybe suffered quite a bit, from the point of view of Buddha's awakening, were all like play. They were all like divine expression of the universe through this person who had to enact this so that this sutra could come to us. It's not exactly like his whole life was predestined, but there is the story that all great Buddhas basically enact their lives in this play, the same kind of play in whatever era they're living. So, the story, you know, could begin with Buddha's birth or much earlier, but to speak of the time just leading up to his awakening. Yesterday we talked about the Buddha's leaving home, leaving the palace life. Again, for those who have heard this story, probably most people have heard the life of Buddha in one version or another, but I chose this particular sutra because it's kind of unusual, Mahayana slant on the Buddha's life. So he had left home, traded in his princely clothes for the patched robe of a beggar, and cut off his hair, letting go of all his adornments, and left the palace. And so that was kind of a play, you could say, from the Mahayana perspective, it's also said that the Buddha was, in a way, already the Buddha from birth, but he still had to go through these particular stages and act out this play. The play had to be performed. And my teacher sometimes says, from the perspective of enlightenment or Buddha's awakening, that everything is, like we could say, a play or like a ritual. That from, you know, from outside the perspective of Buddha's awakening, like we do certain rituals during sesshin, like chanting and oryoki meals and stuff, and we think that those are these special rituals, and then the rest of our life is like real life. But from the point of view of Buddha's awakening, everything throughout our whole life is basically a ritual. It's an interesting way of thinking about life, and it gives a different take on all these Zen rituals that we do. Like, they're not actually something special that we're just doing some Zen ritual enactment. It's just reminding us that our whole life is ritual, and so we do it in this particular way to remind us of that. So I could say the Buddha's whole life, these things that he did, was a ritual. So a ritual enactment of a bodhisattva's renunciation to leave home, put on patch robes and shave off his head hair. And so now we still, then the Buddha said, well, if people want to practice my way, they can do that ritual enactment. And sometimes when I think about it, I'm amazed that this has still come down to America 2,500 years later. We still do this, particularly at we sometimes call priest ordination, which literally is called shuke, which means leaving home. So we ritually enact leaving home, though we might live in a palace or what we might call a home sometimes. We wholeheartedly enact the Buddha's leaving home by trading in our clothes for the Buddha's patch robe, which we sew, and cutting off the hair like Buddha. So we ritually celebrate his ancient ritual individually, even in modern times. And even at Jukai, or lay initiation, receiving the precepts ceremony, still it's actually the same ritual enactment of the rakasu that people are wearing, is Buddha's patch robe that symbolizes these the renunciation of using what comes to hand, the pieces of cloth that come to hand, and it's given, just like the Buddha's robe was given. And if for those who were at Harry's Jukai ceremony, it's even like a little piece of hair is snipped. Not all cut off, but a little piece of hair is snipped in that same ritual, symbolic enactment. So this is the original story. The Buddha's now out in the woods wearing these rags, and then he starts practicing austerities. So you probably heard the story. Buddha was this seemed like from this Buddha perspective, this was an enactment that had to be performed. It's part of what had to happen. We could say the basic point was that the Buddha could see that desire, craving, is the origin of suffering, even before he discovered the Four Noble Truths. And this was already understood in India of Buddha's time. So he's like, well, let's just anything where that that I desire, like food, I'll just stop. Basically, he virtually stopped eating. And the Buddha says in the sutra, thus, monks, the Bodhisattva, referring to himself, the pre-Buddha was, he called himself the Bodhisattva, one who is has this wish and this vow to realize Bodhi or Buddhahood. In order to cause marvelous actions to be seen in the world, to guide the actions and karma of beings whose actions were defiled, to express his accumulation of merits, to show the virtues of great knowledge, to define clearly the stages of meditation, manifested for 6 years the practice difficult to accomplish, eating but a single juniper berry and a single grain of rice each day. So as this was in order to call these marvelous actions to be seen in the world. He did this manifestation. He enacted this play of eating a juniper berry and a grain of rice. His mind never dejected. The Bodhisattva remained for 6 years with his legs crossed, abiding just so and never deviating from the path of pure action. And also part of his renunciation was when the sun fell on him, he did not move into the shade. And from the shade, he did not move into the sun. He did not seek refuge from wind, sun, or rain. He did not chase away horseflies, mosquitoes, or snakes. He didn't get up or stretch. He didn't lie down on his stomach, back, or side. The great storms and tempests, the rain and hail of autumn, spring, and winter descended on the Bodhisattva, who at the end did not even try to shelter himself with his hand. He did not fight his senses, nor did he welcome the objects of the senses. That's the principle behind these strange and extreme practices. He didn't fight the senses, nor did he welcome the objects of the senses. He tried to just be totally still with whatever weather mosquitoes came to him. So this admittedly sounds quite extreme, but some spirit like this, the spirit of really surrendering, really letting go, is the spirit of Sesshin too, is it not? We have to, whether we want to or not, we're basically forced into, once we're here, this situation of like not being able to get too comfortable. And I think it's good to try to be, take care of our body and mind, find a comfortable way to be in this uncomfortable situation of sitting for 7 days. But it's a little bit like that. Sometimes the zendo is too hot and sometimes it's too cold. And sometimes a lot of wind is happening and sometimes bugs are coming in. And sometimes the food's not quite what we like. We usually get more than a juniper berry from our kind Tenzo. So this was the Buddha's enactment. His play at this stage was to just basically give up and not do anything in the face of what's happening. Another thing my teacher used to say was, in Zen, when people would ask about, well, what about this kind of ascetic practice in Zen or austerities in Zen, and he says, Zen is, we have streamlined asceticism, meaning Zazen. Zazen is kind of streamlined asceticism, meaning like just don't move, just sit. And not moving may mean occasionally moving, but in the sesshin we know that it's a kind of training. I think the word asceticism actually comes from the root of training. It's kind of a body-mind training related to athlete, I'm pretty sure, etymologically, athletics and ascetics. The young men and young girls of the village who passed by, this was in the on the banks of the Nirinjara River, with present-day Bodh Gaya. Those who passed by, the cowherds, the grass or wood gatherers or collectors of cow dung, thought, he's a dust demon. And they made fun of him and covered him with dust. So not only was he wasn't like totally secluded, right? There were people walking around, and they would, and they actually teased him. So this is like the great Shakyamuni Buddha to be, you know, the kids just played with him and teased him. I'm just recalling this time. I've been to the Bodhi tree, this seat of the Buddha, I guess three times. And one of the times I was there, at that time it was like there's a little kind of fence around the Bodhi tree, which last time I went you couldn't quite go in there. I think they're trying to protect this really ancient tree from people like even touching it. But at that time you could go and sit kind of like right next to the dirt around the tree and inside that fence at these certain times of the day. You can still definitely sit under it, but not right up next to the trunk. And of course that's what people do when they go there. There's people sitting there all and chanting and walking around and bowing to this spot, the Buddha's Vajra seat, where this event happened. I remember this sitting there and a kid, you know, there's all these like Indian tourists coming through, and it was like a little Indian 5-year-old or something was there, and I was just sitting zazen, but there's, you know, people all around, but other people are sitting, and I remember him picking up the dirt from the base of the tree and throwing it at me to see if I'd move or anything. And just kept doing it until his mom discovered him and said, stop that! Go, stay, don't. But now, you know, at the time it was kind of annoying, but just hearing this story now, I think, what an amazing, great blessing to sit under the Bodhi tree and have kids throw dust at me like the Buddha. So then there's all these verses the Buddha saying, talking about this time, and one of them is, he strives not for himself alone, but applies himself out of compassion for others, contemplating great benefit for the world. This is a scene we talked about yesterday of the Zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors is permeated with, infused with great compassion. So saying, from this sutra, it looks like the Buddha wasn't just into this gaining idea of I have to get over birth, old age, sickness, and death, and escape samsara and all these annoying people around me. It was instead striving not for himself alone, but applying himself out of compassion for others, contemplating great benefit for the world. The next chapter is called the Nairanjana River. Oh, monks, during the 6 years that the Bodhisattva practiced austerities, the demon Papillon, which is another name for Mara, so Mara is going to have a big part in this story coming up. And maybe a part in our very own story. During Sasheen, we may be visited by Mara, the evil one, who appeared throughout Buddha's life, but particularly on that night of his enlightenment, seeing him getting closer and closer to the awakening of a Buddha. The demon of Mara tried anything to prevent his Buddhahood unsuccessfully, and we'll hear that story on a future day. But Mara was there all along, following behind him step by step, seeking an opportunity to harm him. But he found no opportunity whatsoever and went away discouraged and content. And now, in verse form, the Buddha is saying, there in the pleasant forests and woods among the thickets lush with vines to the east of Uruvilva, where the Nairanjana River flows, Namuchi, or Papillon, or Mara, approaches the one who applies himself to renunciation, striving zealously for perfection, firm in his valor. Mara approaches, speaking sweetly, Shakya-san, arise! What need have you to weary yourself? Life is most valuable for the living. In living you will practice the Dharma. The living can act in such a way that their deeds do not bring sorrow. You're weak, discolored, defeated. Death approaches, death which has 1,000 parts, while life has only one. Great merit comes from giving alms and making fire offerings when one can. What can you do by renunciation? Sorrowful is the path to renunciation, difficult the submission of the mind. This is Mara's discourse of the moment addressed to the Bodhisattva. So Buddha says, Mara says, don't torture yourself so much, come on. Let up. And make offerings and create merit, which is an important practice. And the Buddha had done this for countless lifetimes, and now he had to go deeper. And the Bodhisattva replies to Mara, Mara, ally of those gone mad, you have come out of self-interest alone. So Mara has a gaining idea, actually. Mara doesn't have great compassion. Mara comes out of self-interest alone. You have not the slightest concern for my merit. O Mara, whoever is truly interested in virtue would speak like this. I do not think of immortality, for life assuredly has death at its end. Yet I will not turn back. I am practicing purity. I have no concern for my body or life. See the pureness of my rigor. Firm in my purpose and effort, I have wisdom as well. In this whole world, I see no one who could move me from my endeavor. Though he takes no pride in the victory, Only the hero can conquer an army. The timid do not succeed. Soon, Mara, I will overcome you. And then the Buddha teaches the teaching of the eight armies of Mara. And this is a one of those classic Buddhist lists, a little bit obscure. But Mara has these eight armies that come, and I think it's a nice list because these are the forms that Mara will visit us in Sesshin, these eight ways. Desires are your first army. The second is discontent. The third is hunger and thirst. Covetousness is the fourth. The fifth is laziness and indolence. Fear is said to be the sixth. The seventh is doubt. Anger and hypocrisy make the eighth. So, desire, discontent, hunger and thirst, covetousness, laziness and indolence, fear, doubt, anger, and hypocrisy. I would even venture to say, if we're actually sitting here for all 7 days, probably all eight of these armies will visit us in one form or another. You can keep your eye out for them. And when they come, say, Mara, you don't have the slightest concern for my merit. You come out of self-interest alone. And the Buddha goes on to say, ambition, praise, and respect, falsely acquired renown, self-glorification that puts others down, such is the army of Mara. Allies of the dark and burning ones, to them the shramanas and brahmins succumb. All these practitioners usually give in to one of Mara's armies. And Buddha says, I will act with understanding, for my mind is established in mindfulness, and I have meditated well on wisdom. But your mind is set on wickedness, Mara, so what can you accomplish? At these words, Mara, confused, humiliated, and full of resentment, at once disappeared from that very place. So basically, when the Buddha just sees Mara, kind of, Mara kind of likes to sneak in from behind and attack. But when Buddha is clearly aware and sees Mara, Mara just disappears. And I find that in these early sutras, after the Buddha's great enlightenment, still Mara comes and visits. It's so interesting. You think, well, isn't he like the completely perfected one? How could Mara even like come near the Buddha? But even near the end of Buddha's life, Mara comes and says, you've done your work, Buddha. You know, you did what you set out to accomplish. Now is the time to enter parinirvana. And, you know, it was near the end of his life, but the Buddha's like, not yet, Mara. Soon, okay? But there's still a little bit more to do. So there's times like that. It's these little traces of Mara that were they residing in the Buddha's mind stream at the Buddha? Or was it part of the play that had to be enacted? Today's episode from the Buddha. Now the Buddha's teaching in the sutra Unlocking the Mysteries, the meditation instructions that also investigate this Sesshin. The beginning of this chapter in the Sandinirmochana Sutra, where the Bodhisattva Maitreya asks the Bhagavan, the Buddha, abiding in what and depending upon what do Bodhisattvas in the great vehicle cultivate shamatha and vipassana, calm abiding and insight. And the Buddha said, Maitreya, abiding in and depending upon an unwavering resolution to teach the Dharma of liberation and to realize unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment, Bodhisattvas cultivate the meditation of calm abiding and insight. So, based on their bodhicitta, on their compassionate wish for others. Next, the Buddha says, the Bhagavan has taught that four things are objects of observation of calm abiding and insight, shamatha and vipassana. Four things are objects of observation. So in this presentation, every type of Buddha's meditation has some object of observation. Means like the we're always observing something in meditation. And I think we could even say outside of meditation, there's always an object of observation, an object of mind. Now, as we'll see as this description goes on in later days, that these objects in the culmination of these meditations are not really objects, actually. But for the time being, even when talking about the union of calm abiding and insight, still the Buddha is saying there's what's observed is an object of mind. Four things are objects of observation, and like everything's included in these four. So if you're sitting zazen, you can look for what's the object of observation. Now, if you're really distracted, there's still an object of observation, even if you're not meditating. It's the object of mind is like the story about what happened yesterday that I'm thinking about during zazen. So you could say that would be the object of observation. But here's these particular kinds for these meditations. And the four are conceptual images, non-conceptual images, the limits of phenomena, and accomplishment of the purpose. These are the four all-encompassing objects of observation for meditation. So Maitreya asks, Bhagavan, how many of these are objects of observation of shamatha, of calm abiding? The Buddha says, one. Do you know which one of the four? Anyone want to guess? Of conceptual images, non-conceptual images, we haven't talked about what the limits of phenomena and accomplishment of the purpose mean. But you want to take any guesses of what the one object of observation for shamatha or calm abiding is?
Non-perceptual
objects. Yeah, or in this case it's called non-conceptual images. That's right. Yeah. One, non-conceptual images are the object of observation for calm abiding. Calm abiding is not using conceptual thought. It's like letting go of conceptual thought is the practice of entering shamatha or calm abiding. And then the Buddha says, how many are objects of observation of vipassana? And the Buddha says, one. Conceptual images. Right, so this is a great little, so far, it's a great little preliminary definition of these two types, almost like a definition of these two types of two aspects of meditation, calm abiding and insight, which are this pair that are going to come together in the end. But at this point they're split into two aspects. And generally calm abiding, shamatha side is taught first, and often when you hear about it, it might seem like, well, in Zen, isn't that what we're talking about all the time? And maybe Zen is emphasizing this calm abiding part, and maybe we could say it's emphasizing calm abiding and the union of calm abiding and insight. But in Zen, we don't talk about during Zazen time meditating on conceptual images too much. But this is something we can explore. Yes.
Before we go on, I need help. I mean, I don't really know I don't have an idea about what those two things are.
Non-conceptual and conceptual images. Yeah, so...
Especially non-conceptual images.
Yeah, yeah. And some of this, you know, the wording and the translations could be confusing from this, you know, translated, this one's from the Sanskrit to the Tibetan to English. So images is a funny word there, I agree. but basically, that non-conceptual images is actually what it says, like in Sanskrit. Supposedly, we don't have the Sanskrit of the sutra anymore, it was lost. We have Tibetan and Chinese versions. But they can look at other Chinese and Tibetan sutras that where we do have the Sanskrit originals, and they can align these terms and kind of they back translate. So people have kind of back translated their guess of what the Sanskrit was, and so they say that this word is nirvikalpa, non-conceptual. Which is used in yoga traditions too, right? Which generally means without thinking, or without thinking or imagination. Kalpa in this case, not like the eon, but like parikalpita in Yogacara is that the complete imagination, the imaginary character of phenomena. Created by thought. So this is nirvikalpa, without conceptual thought. Though it does say that, again, Tenshin Roshi, my teacher, who is his commentary on this sutra will hopefully come out in print in the next year or so. When studying this, he would say that his understanding was that if you look more carefully, it's not really, the objects of observation of shamatha are not really non-conceptual images, but just non-conceptually elaborated images, which would be like, for example, the breath is a common object of observation of meditation. When you say follow the breath, that's the technical way of saying that is, what's your object of observation in meditation? You'd say the breath. That's what the object that the mind is focused on while meditating. And the reason the breath is chosen for particularly calming the mind, and we'll see the reasons for calming the mind as this goes on, but it's not just for the sake of calm, actually. It's for the sake of insight. But at this point, we're just focusing on calming the mind, and you're using the breath. The reason we choose the breath is because it's not, there's not much conceptual elaboration around the breath. It's not, you don't have to think about like, well, how is the breath doing? It's just this physical sensation moving in and out, and you're just attending to the physical sensation. But Tenshin Roshi would say, actually, when you're meditating on the breath, it is actually a concept of the breath. It's, even when you're not elaborating on it, you're not thinking about it, still to actually say, to have the intention, I'm going to follow the breath and I feel this movement down here. It's a quite a subtle concept, but he would say, strictly speaking, it's just a plain concept. There's no, without any, ideally, if you're really focused on you just becoming one with the breath, there's no elaboration about like assessing the breath or assessing anything else. Still, it's the breath itself is a kind of a subtle concept, but it's not elaborated. So we could say that the object of observation of shamatha, instead of saying it's non-conceptual objects, you could say it's just non-conceptually elaborated objects.
It feels like the mind is uncomfortable without a concept.
Yes, it is.
And so I'm sitting here realizing that from part of consciousness is in this whole dance of, is this conscious if I can't describe it? And then where's the willingness to just be and not answer that question? I think it comes down to the kind of question of do I exist if I can't have the language to name the reality? But just then where is the, where physically and mentally is the willingness present? It's like somewhere in my gut. It's somewhere like, but,
in the dantian.
Yeah.
And I think you hit it when you answered the question, or when you said the question of why is it that it's so uncomfortable to let go of conceptual thing. Of conceptual thought, I think the main reason is because we can't define ourselves anymore. We like, who am I without conceptual thought? That would be my guess of why it's so difficult and uncomfortable for us to really like just be present without some little commentary about what's happening, because we kind of like. We, ourself, is kind of like drops away at that point, and that's not comfortable for a self. The self's trying to preserve itself. So, and this is not the complete realization of no abiding self, but just in just calm abiding, just to like settle the mind into this non-discursive, non-elaborated, mere concept. Of like the breath, even that is enough of like our familiar container of the world and ourself in it. That whole thing starts to dissolve, and ironically, it's uncomfortable to the self. We could even say it's like Mara's in there. Mara's the one who's saying. Like the Buddha says, Mara, you only act out of your own self-concern. We could actually say Mara is the independent, that this, you know, false view of the independent self. That's what Mara actually is. And his job is to, like, maintain himself at all costs. And the closer we get to seeing through Mara, the more armies Mara will bring on. So... just settling down into the present. It can be very uncomfortable, but then the irony of it is when we actually do settle into the present, by its name, calm abiding, is is a hint that it's like the most comfortable place. That's the irony of it. It's like as we get closer and closer, it seems uncomfortable, but actually it's when it's, you know, both physically and mentally totally comfortable, when we're actually have, according to the sutra we'll see, actually reaching calm abiding. There's all kinds of territory the Buddha talks about leading up to. But at the culmination, the body and mind are flexible and comfortable and at ease. So, yeah, how do we approach that? This may be your basic question is, how do we find how can we practice that? And where does that come from? Where does the willingness come from? And maybe it does come from dhara, tanden, or something other than our mind. And that's the beauty of sesshin, though, too, is just sitting this much, we become more and more willing. I mean, we have our times and our days, maybe, of unwillingness, but it's like we're... Zazen is encouraging us to surrender conceptual elaboration. Sometimes it might take 7 days or much longer. Or we have our moments and then just after the such a peaceful, calm moment, then Mara's really gets activated. Like, whoa, not so quick there. Kid, take this. So, where does that willingness come from? It's like, yeah, I think we can't figure it. Trying to figure it out is more conceptual elaboration. Just sitting, dropping into the present is all we can do. And noticing when we're not doing that. And then remembering also, it maybe comes from remembering this vow. If we take up this whole sutra presentation, that abiding in what does one cultivate? This calm abiding. It's like that's the root thing, right? Abiding in this unwavering resolution to. Realize complete freedom and awakeness in order to help others. This compassionate vow might also help us to let go. So a little more on this section. So there's this, again, there's four objects of observation of shamatha and vipassana. How many of these are objects of observation or shamatha? One, non-conceptual images, or we might say conceptual but not conceptually elaborated images, like the breath. And in this sutra, quite wonderfully, in this case, he's not even going to mention the breath or other classical meditation objects like... like focusing on a Buddha image or a white light or a mantra or all these objects that you can use. Discs, yeah, kasina. colored discs. Many, many objects of in Buddhism, classical Buddha Dharma, many, many meditation objects that can be used. But here in this Mahayana Sutra, the non-conceptual object is like the awareness itself. We'll get to that part later, but very much in accord with the Zen teachings of there's no special object. We might also call it like unsupported shamatha, where there's no, it's calm abiding, but there's no particular object. Like definitive object, like this particular breath and this particular place in the body, but more like turning the light back towards awareness itself, as a shamatha practice, as a calm abiding practice, not, and then that's going to be woven into how that's connected to insight too. But at this point he's just saying non-conceptually elaborated images are the object of observation for shamatha, or calm abiding. Conceptual images are the objects of observation for insight. And that could be as conceptual as like the Four Noble Truths, any Dharma teaching, even like this, even these instructions on shamatha and vipassana are coming in conceptual words right now. And you could, during Zazen time, you could think about, you could review these four objects, and that would be like a kind of like maybe preliminary type of vipassana meditation using conceptual ideas. Sadgasho.
Concentration.
Interesting. It's almost like a different system that when they break meditation into shamatha and vipassana, but also sometimes meditation or practice is broken down into concentration and wisdom, like the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. The Sixth Ancestor talks about Zazen having like this aspect of samadhi and prajna, and then the union of samadhi and prajna. Samadhi as one-pointed concentration, prajna as like wisdom of reality. And so I think we can correlate those. I think we could see it maybe not exactly the same, but it's a little bit like concentration's like calm abiding and wisdom is like insight. Especially wisdom and insight, I think, very similar. Concentration, samadhi and shamatha. Are closely related. It's like concentration, I think we could say concentration would be an aspect of shamatha. But interestingly, it's emphasizing not so much the one-pointed concentration, you know, the burning laser beam of concentration, but emphasizing the calm. That literally means calm or relaxation. Which creates this flexible, soft, open, pliable body and mind that's very conducive to realizing insight. So concentration is definitely in there, but this sutra is emphasizing the calming, settling aspect.
The laser beam doesn't fit, but the aspect of concentration that's coming back to the place of that's kind of coming back to that.
We could also say, even just to have an object of observation is a kind of concentration. So we could say concentration is totally necessary for both shamatha and vipassana. To actually focus on any object of observation, we need concentration. But then this is what the results of the concentration are, these two things called shamatha and vipassana. That might be another way to talk about it. I think the concentration does come in later in the, they get defined more fully. They also do use the word samadhi later here. The Buddha says the images that are the focus of samadhi. So talking about these objects are the focus of concentration. And I think in the definition of shamatha, it also might come up again, concentration. So So non-conceptual images, conceptual images, and then Maitreya asks, how many are objects of observation of both shamatha and vipassana? And the Buddha says two. So this is covering all four. The other two objects are the objects of observation for when calm, abiding, and insight are conjoined, are united. The object, when they're united, is these other two called the limits of phenomena and the accomplishment of the purpose, which are funny ways of talking about, according to commentaries, the limits of phenomena are like understanding everything, like to its farthest limits, understanding all phenomena, both in their appearing manifestations and particularly in their ultimate truth of suchness. So, as a simplification, I think the main point is to say suchness is an object of observation of shamatha and vipassana united. Suchness, or the thoroughly established character, or non-duality, or emptiness of all phenomena. And then accomplishment of the purpose in this sutra, in this Yogacara sutra, is the transformation of the basis of consciousness, transformation of the storehouse consciousness into perfect mirror wisdom at Buddhahood. And also the Dharmakaya is the accomplishment of the purpose of this Buddha's great vow. So when these shamatha and vipassana are united, the object of observation is the Dharmakaya, or we could also say Buddhahood. So these two aspects, I think we could summarize them. To me it seems like summarizing them as like suchness, the way things truly are beyond all appearances, and Buddhahood itself. So the total culmination. So that sounds like something interesting to observe. So when these two are completely united, that's like Buddha's, a completely realized Buddha's meditation, is the union of calm abiding and complete insight.
So you're saying the combined of vipassana and shamatha is suchness?
Well, I guess technically it would be the object of observation for the union of those two is suchness. Now, when we say, so is the union of those, I mean, there are two kinds of meditation. When those two kinds of meditation are practiced as one meditation, we could say, is that meditation suchness? Well, I think we can say that too, because the object of observation, that's partly what suchness, well, it's completely what suchness means, is that the object, and actually the sutra says this very beautifully later on here, that the it's when the object of observation is seen to be not an external object. It's the realization of non-duality is also called suchness. So even though it says the object of observation is suchness, we could say the meditation also becomes suchness and the person becomes suchness. There's only one suchness.
Thinking of suchness and thinking of it as objectless.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
But in this conversation, it isn't.
It's almost like it's saying, yeah, the object of this complete meditation is not an object. We could say that, yeah. Because suchness is not an object, really. But when he's talking about these four objects of observation, it's like it's kind of Buddha's play again. He could say, well, if you want to know what the object is there, it's like the end of all objects. But, you know, because that's what suchness is.
Yeah.
It's the end of subject and object duality. And as we know from the song of the trusting mind, maybe we don't chant that part. Subject is subject because of the object. Object is object because of the subject. There aren't objects apart from subjects, which is, so in duality, there's objects.
Apart from duality, but there's still something there.
Well, suchness. And is that a thing? Not really a thing, and yet it could maybe provisionally be spoken of as an object of observation, you know, in quotes maybe. Patrick, yeah, of
course. Well, I'm just thinking about Nagarjuna's terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is shamatha a condition for vipassana, vipassana?
Mm-hmm.
When you think in terms of you're doing one thing or doing another, mm-hmm. and then doing both,
mm-hmm.
is shamatha sort of like the ground that you have to plant the seed in, so it needs to be there to have vipassana?
Hmm.
Or does it stop? You know?
Yeah.
Totally stop and then vipassana begins. And in that case, you know, Nagarjuna says they're not connected.
Ah, interesting. Yeah.
So how can you have vipassana?
Good point.
Without the shamatha?
It's kind of like for the sake of the sutra, in this case, the Buddha seems to be breaking meditation apart into these two aspects of shamatha and vipassana, but then he talks about when they're combined too. So he's kind of implying that you can have one without the other, and he describes, as we'll go through this later, how he's presenting that. Particularly, it looks like it's quite possible to have shamatha without vipassana, which would be like you're in this non-conceptually elaborated ease, but there's no insight that this is actually the nature of reality. One actually doesn't realize that. Now, is it possible to have vipassana without shamatha? It kind of sounds like the way it's presented here is that it is in this kind of preliminary kind of vipassana where you're just actually contemplating conceptual teachings like we're doing now. This is kind of like an insight practice that we're, how we're thinking about how this stuff works. But it's not like the fully realized insight, the non-conceptual insight.
We kind of talk about, you know, leaving the Zendo at 6:25 in the morning, you know, facing the world with the mind of Zazen.
Mm-hmm.
And what a different experience of the world that is. We use that to recommend this 5:45.
Yeah. I think there's some insight when we're going about the world. There's some, I mean.
The shamatha or zazen is sort of groundwork.
Yeah.
Allows insight to flourish.
Yeah. And as the Buddha says in the sutra here, there's Maitreya asks, well, prior to attaining this physical and mental ease of, called shamatha, when a bodhisattva inwardly attends to the mind, what is this called? And the Buddha says, it's not shamatha, but it does resemble this intensified interest concordant with shamatha. And then similarly with vipassana, prior to also this attaining this physical and mental pliancy, when one just contemplates the Buddha's teachings, what's this called? And Maitreya says, or the Buddha says, it's not vipassana, actually, but it does resemble intensified interest in concordance with. It's like very related to vipassana. So he's saying, he kind of like gives these kind of culmination definitions, but then he says, anything that you're practicing, when you're trying to practice these things, it's still really great. It's just, we maybe strictly speaking, don't call it the realization of shamatha and vipassana defined as it is here. But I think that does happen. We get, even if we're pretty distracted, when we come at 5:45 and calm the mind some, it's concordant with shamatha. And then when we go out and we contemplate, we're in some difficult situation and we contemplate how, well, maybe it's not really the way I think it is. We just think like that. That's kind of like in concordance with vipassana. I think we do. So that's why this is not like an all or nothing kind of thing. And then there's all these degrees of more and more deeply realizing both these aspects, and then they're being united. I think it's an interesting question, though, is do they depend on each other? Because it's kind of like as the Buddha goes on, it's like they're presented, like, here's one practice and here's the other, and then you can unite them. So it sounds like you could practice them independently of each other, it seems like, according to this version. But for the realization of Buddhahood, then they need to completely depend on each other and need to be, when they're, I think, united, another way of saying the union of the yoga, I sometimes say the yoga of shamatha and vipassana, is where their union is is when they're completely interdependent. I think that's their relationship. It's not exactly like they're one. It's more like they're completely interdependent and working interdependently. And usually, traditionally, there's that order that one first practices shamatha and then vipassana. It doesn't have to be in that order. Oh, and also, as you were asking, well, are they always interdependent? I thought of in Zen how these terms almost never come up in Zen teachings, shamatha and vipassana. They're used all the time in Qiantai, which is this Chinese forerunner to Zen. It's all about shamatha and vipassana. Juri, the founder of Qiantai school. But when it got to Zen, they virtually these never appear, these terms, as such. And one theory of why that's so is because Zen is like just pointing at this final culmination of this union where there's no dualism between shamatha and vipassana anymore. Zen just like, that's part of its trademark thing, is it just goes right to like the culmination and just sitting. And like, well, it's just sitting, shamatha, vipassana. And you just get hit if you ask. It's just like, you know. And then, please tell me, well, if we have to say, then, oh, yes, if it's the union of shamatha and vipassana, where those can't be distinguished at all. But we're not even going to talk about two aspects because we emphasize non-duality so much. But and one kind of place where a Zen conversation, classic Zen conversation, that's kind of like about the union of shamatha and vipassana, is that place in the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, where Huainong is saying, where are samadhi and prajna the same or different? And concentration and wisdom the same or different? And he says that they're not different. It's like a candle and its light, things like that, images like that. Yeah, so we might even say, especially when you hear the description of shamatha, that's like basically just meditating on awareness itself without any conceptual elaboration. That sounds kind of like non-duality, but it's just talking about shamatha. So I think that's part of the brilliant teaching in this sutra. It's very kind of Zen oriented, even though Zen people never actually picked up on this sutra particularly. That actually, right there in the shamatha is the full thing, but we don't realize that. We need the vipassana to appreciate the fact that resting in mind itself is actually the way everything truly is. It's not just like a meditation state. It's like, or if we can actually settle into non-conceptual elaboration and just the mind is the object and there's nothing outside of it, that's kind of like realization of suchness. The Buddha does some good things here later too, but we have 5 more days. Yes. No, please, go ahead.
I was actually not.
Oh, yeah.
Just
resting, okay. the last bit is...
What?
Covering the candy. Hakuin Zenji's Rohatsu exhortation, second night. Yeah, they were quite simple. Like, you who practice Zen samadhi must first of all prepare a thick cushion and sit on it. So, everyone got it? And then sit up straight and become well settled, and then count breaths. Among innumerable ways to enter samadhi, breath counting is the best on the first day. Start with practicing shamatha with a non-elaborated concept like the breath. Fill your dantian with qi, then directly engage your koan. And then do this for months and years. And make the utmost endeavor. The second night, Hakuin said to the monks, this is the 7 nights of Rohatsu Sesshin in the 1800s. In the Sharangama Sutra, it said, when one person accomplishes the way and takes refuge in truth, even the vast universe in the 10 directions will be completely relinquished or let go of. When one person accomplishes the way and takes refuge in truth, even the vast universe in 10 directions will be let go of. Wherever the way is practiced, that's the quote from the sutra. Now Hakuin says, wherever the way is practiced, there are dharma protecting deities or spirits and disturbing Mara spirits. For example, when many people gather together in a castle town, thieves go among them too. When the vow in your heart is strong, the dharma-protecting spirits gain strength. When a Mara demon invades your heart, then the disturbing spirits gain strength. We have dharma-protecting spirits like Ida Songten is a dharma protector out on the path here that we can invoke to protect the Dharma in this session, and in some places they say everyone who's practicing and supporting a temple are the Dharma protectors. So all anyone who's just helping to support practice in any possible way are Dharma protectors. Wherever the way is practiced, there are karma protectors and Mara spirits. Therefore, you who practice the way, first of all, must have a great vow. Be humble in your words and deeds. It is essential to offer your heart to all sentient beings and to liberate them without exception. So same teaching keeps coming up, right? That we're doing this for all beings. As for the great way of the Buddhas and ancestors, not a single one accomplished the way without a great vow. It's like a person who's learning archery. He tries to shoot the bullseye arrow after arrow. Even though at first he's unable to hit the target, if he practices for a long time without ceasing, he will get the knack of it. The practice of Zazen is like this. So, if you feel like you've been aiming at the bullseye all day and missing every time with this object of observation of non-conceptual elaborated images, if you practice for a long time without ceasing, you'll get the knack of it. The practice of Zazen is like this. Thought after thought, mind moment after mind moment, you must cultivate your aspiration. You must purify your spirit and thoroughly penetrate the depths of the great way. Thus, thought after thought, if you don't run away, all the Dharma principles will appear in front of you. Attainment of supreme awakening is then like picking up dust from the ground. It's very encouraging to watch people sitting in this sesshin. People are sitting very upright and very still. We sometimes adjust postures. I did that once as the sesshin. It's kind of like a ritual. It's part of the play of sesshin. But I kind of felt like it's not really necessary because people are like really sitting well. So after one day, very, very settled in here yesterday, in the afternoon and evening. So please continue this steadfast, effortless effort. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.